KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
I think Trump went further in 2 months than Orban could in 15 years.
Hungary's Viktor Orban has pushed that country away from democracy. Now, those strategies are being studied and copied in the West. For Sunday, April 20th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Miles Parks. Happy Easter to those who celebrate. We'll hear from the Pope, who's still recovering from a near-fatal illness. His speech condemned the marginalization of migrants across the world.
This is a message for our country leaders, and they should listen to him.
And best-selling romance author Emily Henry. Her new book has a lot of love, but also a lot of loss.
I generally find it kind of hard to write a love story where you don't deal with grief a little bit, partly because I think grief is the flip side of love.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Russia and Ukraine are blaming each other for carrying out attacks in violation of a temporary Easter Day ceasefire. NPR's Charles Maines has more from Moscow.
Even before the Easter ceasefire technically went into effect, both sides voiced skepticism the truce would hold. Putin warned of possible Ukrainian provocations, and Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, suggested the offer was more gimmick than peace gesture. Today, Russia's defense ministry said Ukraine carried out hundreds of artillery and drone strikes on Russian-occupied territory in Ukraine. In turn, Zelensky said Russia continued shelling and assault raids across the front line. Neither claim could be independently verified. The ceasefire attempt comes as President Trump has threatened to abandon efforts to negotiate an end to the conflict. We didn't see immediate progress towards peace. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
Maryland Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen says the Trump administration is flouting the courts. This days after he returned from visiting Kilmar Abrego Garcia, a Maryland man illegally deported to a prison in El Salvador. The courts ordered the Trump administration to facilitate his return, but so far they haven't done that. And the White House says Abrego Garcia, whom they claim is a gang member, which he denies, will never come back to the U.S. NPR's Domenico Montanaro has more.
It feels like we really are nearing a constitutional crisis. The administration continues to say it's following court orders and has found ways to walk a very fine line, even if sometimes it seems to be violating the spirit of the law or these emergency orders it's enacting. I mean, the administration's claiming terrorist invasions, that there are state secrets for why they can't tell judges specifics on deportations or what they did or didn't do to bring back someone mistakenly deported because they can't tell a foreign country what to do.
NPR's Domenico Montanaro reporting. Pope Francis had a brief meeting with Vice President Vance this morning in Vatican City. Megan Williams has more.
The Vatican says Pope Francis met privately with Vance on Easter morning to exchange holiday greetings. The brief encounter came a day after Vance held more formal talks with senior Vatican officials. Francis, still recovering from pneumonia, did not attend those meetings. Vance, a Catholic convert, has publicly clashed with the Pope over immigration. Francis has called President Donald Trump's crackdown a, quote, disgrace, and indirectly rebuked Vance for using Christian values to justify hardline immigration policies. The Pope called the immigration policy a, quote, major crisis for the U.S. For NPR News, I'm Megan Williams at the Vatican.
The Boston Marathon is tomorrow. Organizers expect more than 30,000 runners from 128 countries, and they say there's no evidence that participation by foreign athletes has declined because of increased border security. You're listening to NPR News. The National Science Foundation is freezing its grant-making process at the direction of the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE. As NPR's Jonathan Lambert reports, the agency has stopped issuing new grants for basic research.
The National Science Foundation issues billions of dollars worth of research grants to scientists and institutions each year on a rolling basis. On Wednesday, that process came to a halt after DOGE gained access to internal systems, sources told NPR. All proposals that had been approved for funding were sent back to NSF staff for further review, though it's unclear why. Earlier this year, NSF reviewed all its grants, flagging many for diversity, equity, and inclusion-related terms. An NSF spokesperson told NPR the agency continues to issue new awards, publicly available data reflect a stoppage that started Wednesday. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
Google will be back in court tomorrow for the final phase of a landmark antitrust case that could see the online giant broken up. In 2020, a judge ruled it's a monopoly after the Justice Department sued Google, accusing it of paying the makers of web browsers and phones to set Google as the default search engine. Google says it will appeal. The tech company's highly profitable ad business is powered by data it harvests from user activity on Chrome and Google Search. Tomorrow, the Justice Department and Google will present their idea of an appropriate remedy for the monopolistic behavior, which the government says could include selling its Android operating system or spinning off the Chrome browser. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the University at Buffalo. The University at Buffalo is developing new AI technologies with the goal of solving some of society's most pressing challenges. More at buffalo.edu/AI.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Miles Parks, in for Scott Detrow. In the past 15 years as Hungary's prime minister, Viktor Orbán has steadily chipped away at Hungary's democracy. In a speech last month, the 61-year-old leader told supporters there is a special place in hell reserved for opposition politicians, judges, journalists, and those in civil society. As NPR's Rob Schmitz reports from Budapest, Orbán's strategies are being studied, and in some cases copied, by politicians in democracies in the West.
Atop a cobblestone hill overlooking the Danube River and the medieval lanes of Budapest, tour groups surround a changing of the guard ceremony in front of a 13th century Baroque castle. Across the square, construction crews rebuild a centuries-old palace complex. That's where politician Ákos Hadhagyi guides a tour of his own. We are at the Buda Castle, and if you're looking for a symbolic place for corruption, power, and the waste of public money, this is a beautiful venue for that, says Hodhoji as a Chinese tour group marches by. Hodhoji is an independent member of Hungary's parliament. He routinely gives tours showcasing the corruption of Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán's government. The offices for the Prime Minister and his ministers used to be down there next to the Parliament building, he says, pointing to Budapest's other big pointy-towered tourist attraction. But Orbán decided he wanted to move here into a castle. Even Matyos Rákosi, Hungary's most brutal communist dictator, refused to move his office here. But Orbán wants to play king, says Hadhagyi, so the National Gallery may soon be forced to move out of the castle to make way for him. All this construction, Hadhagyi says, represents Orbán's gifts to cronies in the form of lucrative contracts while ensuring Orbán can survey his kingdom from above the capital. Viktor Orbán is in his fourth consecutive term as Prime Minister of Hungary. In that time, he has dismantled democratic checks and balances, taking control of the country's media, civil society, and universities, and consolidated power in himself and his Fidesz party. His step-by-step dismantling of Hungary's democracy is a point of fascination for political scientists around the world, including those advising the Trump administration. But Hadhagyi says Orbán is an easy read. It's not like Orbán is a genius politician, he says. He received his sheet music from Vladimir Putin, who came into power when oil prices were high. He channeled that money into oligarchs, and in return, they bought up Russia's independent media. Orbán franchised that model here in Hungary, says Hadhagyi, except he used European Union funds. The European Union has since frozen funding to Hungary, but not before Orbán took control of much of the country's independent media. What's left of Hungary's independent press can be found in nooks and crannies like this one.
Hello,
in a tiny apartment in central Budapest, a few dozen journalists from what used to be prominent newspapers that were one by one forced to shut down by Orban's government have formed their own newspaper, Mogyor Hang, or Hungarian Voice.
So we started from zero.
Csaba Lukács is managing director of the paper.
Nobody was brave enough to print in Hungary, so we have to find a printing company outside from the country. Until now, our newspaper is printed in Slovakia, in Bratislava, so we have to organize every week transportation of the newspaper.
Hungarian Voice is funded almost entirely through subscriptions, says Lukács. He says it's the only conservative paper in Hungary that is not part of the state propaganda apparatus. Lukács says Orbán has stripped away press freedom in a step-by-step process over the years.
We are not yet in Turkey because the journalists will be not jailed yet. We are not in Russia because nobody was falling out from the windows yet. But day by day, we are getting closer.
And day by day, he says, Viktor Orbán's attacks on the media and civil society get worse. Last month, in a speech commemorating Hungary's 1848 revolution against the Habsburg Empire, Orbán said, "We will dismantle the financial machinery that bought politicians, judges, journalists, pseudo-civil organizations, and political activists." He called these groups stink bugs who have survived the winter and need to be eradicated. A special circle of hell, declared Orbán, awaits them.
Akkor a pokolban külön bugyor várja őket. Ismerünk benneteket.
Political scientist Peter Krekko says Orbán is targeting the last bastions of Western democracy in Hungary.
Orbán just thinks that the West is unable to survive and democratic and liberal practices of the West have weakened the West.
Krekko has mapped out the process Orbán has taken to dismantle Hungary's democracy. Orbán began, he says, by weakening Hungary's courts, filling them with loyalists. He then applied pressure on media companies, either turning them into state propaganda or putting them out of business. Then, says Krekko, Orbán took control over universities, appointing leaders loyal to him. Krekko says Orbán focused on ridding Hungary of any institution capable of checking his power. And he says he sees similarities to how President Donald Trump is carrying out his second term in office. The difference, says Krekko, is the pace at which Trump is operating.
I think Trump went further in 2 months than Orbán could in 15 years. The United States, it reminds me of a constitutional coup where everything happens very rapidly.
In public speeches, President Trump has called Orbán fantastic, respected, and said nobody is a better leader than the Hungarian prime minister. And while Orbán has boasted that his party has shared his strategies with Trump advisors, Krekko doubts the help was very meaningful. He says Hungary serves as more of a conservative fantasy land that mega Republicans can aspire to.
So Hungary as the country where you don't have immigrants, where you don't have woke issues, when gender ideology is not dominant and when family values is strong. So this is clearly a construction of Hungary that has nothing to do with reality.
That's because, says Krekko, Hungary is surrounded by Europe and its open society. Budapest's annual Pride Parade is one of Europe's largest. Last month, Orbán's party pushed a new law through parliament that has banned any assembly that, quote, promotes homosexuality in order to, quote, protect children. This week, Hungary's parliament passed an amendment to the constitution doing the same. At a cafe in Budapest, Pride Parade spokesperson Johanna Majercik says this new law will likely go further than banning the Pride Parade.
So if the government succeeds in banning such a peaceful protest, that means that in the future they will be able to ban or restrict any other peaceful event, any other peaceful demonstration organized by another social group.
Many other Hungarians agree. After this public assembly law passed, tens of thousands of people halted traffic and bridges in the capital in what have become weekly protests. Critics of the new law say Orbán is using the LGBTQ community as a tool to shut down the right of Hungarian citizens to freely assemble in peaceful protests like these, particularly at a time when the opposition to Orbán's rule is beginning to gain momentum. But political analysts say Orbán, nearing the end of his fourth consecutive term as Hungary's prime minister, appears to be, yet again, adapting his step-by-step strategy to hold on to power for as long as he can. Rob Schmitz,
NPR News, Budapest.
The Israeli military released findings today on its investigation of what happened the night troops killed 15 Palestinian medics last month. And it says it's uncovered what it calls several professional failures. NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi was at the military press briefing about the findings today, and she joins us now from Tel Aviv. Hi, Hadil.
Hello.
So tell us more about what we know happened last month.
Right. So what we know is that on March 23rd, Israeli troops who were conducting an operation in Rafah, South Gaza, opened fire on a fire truck and ambulances and killed 15 Palestinian medics. The soldiers then dug a mass grave, buried the bodies, and bulldozed over the vehicles. When the grave was found a week later, the Israeli military said that the ambulances and the fire truck approached the troops suspiciously and they didn't have any lights on. But then, earlier this month, the Palestinian Red Crescent released a video found on the body of one of the killed medics. And that video showed that the vehicles were clearly marked, driving slowly, with emergency lights on and flashing red lights. And that's when the military walked back its original account and said some of their assessment was mistaken and that an investigation was started.
Wow. So what else came out of this briefing about what they found?
Right. So first, the military said that the field commander who ordered the shooting made the decision because of, quote, poor night visibility. We were told repeatedly that the troops were in this war mindset, that they had just shot down a vehicle earlier they said did belong to Hamas, without providing evidence for that, though. The investigation also said that the troops buried the bodies because they wanted to use that road as an evacuation route later. The military said that that decision was understandable, but the decision to crush the ambulances was wrong. But they were adamant that none of this was done to conceal the event. And then Israel said that six of the 15 medics killed were members of Hamas. Now, Israel has said repeatedly that Hamas hides its militants in ambulances. But in this case, when we pressed them, they couldn't really tell us how they knew that these members were from Hamas.
Did the military say anything about whether anyone would be held accountable for what happened?
Right. So first, the military said that the field commander who started the shooting was going to be fired from his position. The commander of the brigade will receive a reprimand for making the decisions that happened after the shooting, including the burial of the medics. And then we press the spokespeople. What, if anything, is going to change after this incident? How will you make sure that this doesn't happen again? And they just insisted that this event was a, quote, operational misunderstanding. They said, we trust in the good intentions of our soldiers, that they already have mechanisms in place to keep this from happening. But then we also know that Palestinians in Gaza and human rights organizations have repeatedly accused the Israeli military of mishandling its own investigations.
NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi in Tel Aviv. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. A Republican senator is criticizing the Trump administration's handling of Kilmar Abrego Garcia's deportation to El Salvador. Senator John Kennedy also says he's keeping an eye on President Trump's response to court orders over the Maryland man. Kennedy tells NBC News Abrego Garcia should never have been sent to El Salvador and should have received a hearing before his illegal deportation to a Salvadorian prison. Maryland Senator Chris Van Hollen, a Democrat who visited Abrego Garcia in El Salvador last week, calls the situation a constitutional crisis. Classes resume tomorrow at Florida State University, 4 days after a mass shooting that left 2 people dead, 6 others wounded. wounded. And the U.S. won the Women's Ice Hockey World Championships in the Czech Republic today. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Easy Cater, a business tool for food designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. From the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And from Lilly Endowment, a private foundation, supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Miles Parks. Pope Francis had a brief meeting today with Vice President J.D. Vance, where the two exchanged Easter greetings. Vance even got chocolate Easter eggs for each of his kids. The two do not see eye to eye on immigration, however. Just 2 months ago, the Pope admonished the Trump administration and Vance for their goals of mass deportation. And today, the Pope's Easter speech condemned the marginalization of migrants across the world. Megan Williams reports from the Vatican.
From the balcony overlooking a St. Peter's Square festooned with spring flowers and palm fronds, Pope Francis lifted his hand in a weak wave to the crowds below and wished them a happy Easter.
Cari fratelli e sorelle, buona Pasqua.
The Pope, though, after leaving hospital last month after 5 weeks, was too frail to lead the Mass or deliver his Urbi et Orbi, the traditional address to Rome and to the world. Instead, it was read by Monsignor Diego Ravelli, who organizes papal masses.
Cristo è risorto, alleluia.
Calling for a Gaza ceasefire, food for the starving, the release of Israeli hostages, and peace in Ukraine, Sudan, the Congo, and other nations. The Pope's speech decried what he referred to as contempt stirred up against the vulnerable, marginalized, and migrants. For Parisian tourists and El Mendi, the Pope's message hit home.
It means a lot because nowadays, with what's happening in US, what's happening in Europe also, this is a message for our country leaders, and they should listen to him. My parents came from Senegal a long time ago. Yeah, this is my story too.
Holly Driggers, visiting from Austin, Texas, says she's not Catholic, but was thrilled to receive the Pope's blessing from the balcony.
I appreciate his stance on social justice, his stance on immigration. I do appreciate that he has taken a stand for the overlooked person in our world.
That stance has caused friction between the Vatican and Vice President J.D. Vance, a Catholic convert.
Happy Easter to you, Father. I know you've not been feeling great, but it's good to see you in better health.
Who, inside the Vatican guest house, exchanged Easter greetings and gifts with the Pope before Francis greeted the crowds. The brief photo op, lasting just minutes, came a day after Vance held formal talks with senior Vatican officials, where, among other issues, immigration was discussed. Vance and the Pope have publicly clashed over the subject, with Francis calling President Donald Trump's crackdown a disgrace. And the Pope indirectly rebuking Vance for using Christian theology to justify the current hardline immigration policies. Today's encounter with Vance underscored the Pope's willingness to engage, including with ideological opponents, despite his poor health. National Catholic Reporter's Christopher White.
I suspect this hospitalization has crystallized for this Pope that he has very little time left. That he wants to use the time that he's been given to be a pastor. And so that's why we see him showing up, making people inside the Vatican quite nervous at a time when his doctors have really urged rest.
The Pope has defied doctors' orders to limit public interaction. Over the past few weeks, he's met with King Charles and Queen Camilla. He's met prisoners and healthcare workers, even kissed babies in St. Peter's Square. Vatican expert Francis X. Rocca says, all that contact is exposing him to more risk.
His decision to flout his doctor's orders so frequently makes people think, oh my gosh, he's one infection away from going back into the hospital. He's gotten sick before and he could easily get sick again.
And while the Vatican insists all is well, behind the scenes, many are quietly preparing for what could come next, says White.
the sort of public line is that the Pope is back and he's governing the church. But I think everyone is aware that we're far closer to a conclave than we've ever been at any point in the Francis papacy.
As he circled St. Peter's Square, nodding to the crowds, the Pope showed no sign of pulling back from public life. For NPR News, I'm Megan Williams at the Vatican.
The first few weeks of being a parent become a blur. At least they have for me. But in that haze, I could still pick out a few details, specifically songs. The ones that played as we sped to the hospital, as I looked at my daughter at sunrise, as I rocked her to sleep at 2 a.m. so many nights. I'm back from parental leave this week, but I cannot stop thinking about the connection between music and parenting. And I could think of no one better to discuss that with than fellow dad and NPR Music, Stephen Thompson. Hey, Stephen.
Hello, Miles.
So good to have you here to talk about this specifically.
Oh, man. This is near and dear to my heart.
Well, I'm wondering, I want to start big picture. Have you found that as somebody who thinks about music for a living, that parenting actually kind of changed how you connected with music or thought about music?
Absolutely. I think I connect to music most strongly through feelings. And I know that sounds like a really corny thing to say, but music has really helped me access a lot of things that, you know, for a variety of reasons have been hard to express over the years. And falling deeply in love with music and developing a real passion for music has given me kind of a cultural language for processing feelings. And I think when you're talking about how important music has been to you as a young parent, that makes all the sense in the world because you are processing new feelings. I don't know about you, but when I became a parent, the first time I held a newborn was 10 weeks before my son was born. I had no experience around small children. I had no experience around babies. I'm the younger of two kids. I wasn't around them a lot as a kid. And so processing the big feelings of what it's like to hold another person in the crook of your elbow, that brings up big feelings that are hard to express. And music is such a wonderful shorthand for processing that stuff.
Okay, so I asked you to bring a couple songs specifically. I brought a couple songs as well that kind of you think of when you think of kind of how parenting has changed your relationship to music. Was there a single song that you thought about when I gave you this homework assignment?
Yeah, the first song that sprung immediately to mind was from an album that came out in 2003, right around the time that, you know, my son was born in 2001, my daughter was born in 2004, and this song dropped in 2003 called Find Love by the band Clem Snide.
Don't let hurricanes hold you back.
And Clem Snide's one of my favorite bands. I've been a super fan for 25 years. His voice, Yves Barzelay, the singer, his voice just absolutely wrecks me. And as a lyricist, he's kind of wry and funny, but that just allows the emotion to hit that much harder when it comes through.
Wrestle bears, bring them to their knees.
Man, I feel like such a connection to the first song that I thought of as well here. I'm curious to hear if you hear it as well. The song I picked was If I Had a Boat by Lyle Lovett, which I had never heard before until the day that we found out that we were having a child. And let's listen to a little bit of it, and then I want to talk about it.
And if I had a boat, I'd go out on the ocean.
We're both mouthing the words to this song right now. But I do feel like there, the things you said about your song, the wry, the humor, I hear that in the Lyle Lovett song. But then at the heart of it, there's also something bigger in both songs to me, like a warmth or a comfort. Are you hearing that as well?
Well, and just deep insight and understanding about humanity kind of presented in this plain but heartfelt way. I mean, when I saw that you were going to play If I Had a Boat, that's one of my favorite songs of all time. Not just a parenting song, not just a country song, not just a song that I discovered working at a grocery store in the 80s.
Oh, really?
That song has just meant the world to me for almost 40 years now. And part of it is a lot of the songs that are going to tweak that parenting nerve in a good way are speaking to just really like fundamentals of life. And that's a lot of what parenting brings up, right? Like you are part of a continuum. You're trying to impart everything you see as good in yourself onto another person and trying to improve humanity, right? Like you're looking at the flaws in yourself and trying to figure out how not to pass those on. That's really heavy stuff. And I think songs that speak to fundamental, beautiful truths but present them in digestible, plain-spoken ways, that's going to have enormous power as a new parent as you're processing these big ideas.
Totally, totally drawn to just the simple ways to understand these things that, like you said earlier, I just never felt before, right? The next song you brought is called Laser Beam by the band Low. Let's listen to it and then hear a little bit about your specific story with it. So my understanding, Stephen, tell me if I'm wrong here, is that this song was playing in the delivery room when one of your children was born. Is that right?
So when my daughter was born, she was the second of my two kids, and I thought a lot about what did I want to be the first song that she heard in the world.
And no this, pressure.
No pressure at all, all the world's songs. You just have to set the tone for this person's entire life. And, you know, my daughter's named Grace, and the chorus of the song, as sung by the late, great Mimi Parker, is just, I need your grace, and she's kind of intoning the word grace.
I need your grace.
When you're thinking about the first voices that your children are going to hear, I recommend Mimi Parker of the band Low, who had one of the most beautiful voices I've ever heard in music. And the songs that we've picked are slower and quieter, but there's a through line with these three songs where they're taking big, grand ideas and simplifying them, making them digestible for our feeble, sleep-deprived brains.
All right, so I do want to kind of pivot the energy a little bit here. We have been living in this sort of kind of peaceful, reflective...
We're in lullaby zone.
Exactly. Lullaby core is what I've been like calling it this year. But then there is this whole nother brand or genre of song that I have found myself drawn to. I listened to Shaboozy's Bar Song probably 150 times. That sort of like get you pumped up, get you amped, I haven't slept in 24 hours sort of energy song. So then your last song that you've brought here is called You'll Be Bright by Cloud Cult.
All the things you love, all the things that may hurt you, all the things you shouldn't do, all the things you want to.
Yeah, I wasn't a brand new parent at this time, but I was getting divorced, and I pray it never happens to you. That will redefine your relationship with your kids in a lot of ways, and it causes you to question a lot of your certainly causes you to question a lot of your decision making. And this song to me, even though my kids weren't newborns when it came out, it put me in those new parenting feelings at just the right time.
I want to ask a big picture question, Stephen, because one of the things I've been thinking about as all of these different songs have hit me in all of these ways to the point where I honestly think I could listen to that Lyle Lovett song and cry at any moment. You know,
oh, yeah.
Like it could just it could just get there now.
Oh, it's just,
for the rest of my life.
For the rest of your life, if you were an actor, you could make yourself cry.
Well,
instantly.
Well, so what is the connection? Your kids are much older than my, you know, 1-year-old is. What is the connection that they have now with these songs that mean so much to you? Is there any sort of connection there? Am I dreaming when I think of like, God, what is my daughter going to think of when she hears If I Had a Boat? You know, what is their connection to these songs?
It's really hard to tell. And the kind of the beauty and the sadness of it is that it's entirely up to them. And one of the pieces of advice that I give to new parents who ask about wanting to impart their cultural loves onto their kids is to say, basically, one, make sure that it's a two-way street and that you're sitting down with them and letting them tell you about the things that they love and let them get you into new things. Let them be conduits of discovery for you as much as you are a conduit of discovery for them. That's one piece of advice. And the other is you just don't control it at all. Your kids are going to be on their own journey. They're going to have their own set of influences, only one of whom is you. And you can hope, and you can hope that that song will radiate for them the way it's radiated for you. You're very lucky in that you are trying to impart one of the greatest songs ever recorded. It is an easy song to love. And I have been able to pass along some of these big parenting songs onto my kids. My kids love Clem Snide. They love Eve Barzilay. My daughter still listens to those demos. If she's struggling to fall asleep, she'll still put those on. She's heard them literally thousands of times. But I don't know that necessarily as she's moving through the world, she's even... It's not her band. Like, she has her own artists that mean a lot to her. I have my own artists that mean a lot to me, and those don't always intersect.
NPR Music's Stephen Thompson, thank you so much for sharing all this with us.
Thank you, Miles.
And if I had a boat, I'd go out on the ocean. And if I had a pony, I'd ride him on my boat. And we could all together go out on the ocean, set me up on my pony, on my boat. Now if I were Roy Rogers, I'd sure not be single.
You're listening to NPR News. The White House has targeted groups that it says work against its policies, like universities and law firms. Nonprofit groups worry they're next, and they're coming together ahead of time to figure out a unified response. NPR correspondent Joseph Shapiro has been talking to some of those nonprofit leaders, and he's in studio with us now. Hi, Joe.
Hey, Miles.
So tell us what you're hearing. What are these nonprofits worried is coming down the road?
Well, they're hearing that the White House is preparing a series of executive orders that would target the work that many of them do. Orders that would give the administration added powers to audit these nonprofit groups, maybe even seize their assets in some cases. So there's worry that the administration's going to target groups, particularly ones that do legal services for immigrants and environmental groups.
So we should emphasize this is still speculative about these executive orders from President Trump, but do these groups have reason to be worried about this?
Yeah, they have lots of reason. Alarm bells went off last week when members of the president's Department of Government Efficiency called one nonprofit and said, hey, we're sending over a team to be embedded with you. We want to look at the work that you're doing, the grants that you get from the government. And, you know, DOGE has been doing this. They've been going into federal agencies, collecting data, laying off staff. But this would be a new step to intervene with a private nonprofit.
And so what happened when the DOGE representatives tried to go to that nonprofit?
Well, they backed off because they found out that the Justice Department had already canceled all the group's federal grants. Mm-hmm. And that nonprofit, it's the Vera Institute. It's known for working on criminal justice reform. In the past, it's provided legal services to immigrants. But here's the thing that worries the nonprofits. The Vera Institute showed us a transcript of the call, and in it, Nate Kavanaugh, the DOGE representative, said the administration, it's planning to send teams to many nonprofits that get government grants. And Kavanaugh cited an example where DOGE took control of another nonprofit, the United States Institute of Peace, and it fired the entire staff of 300 people. Now, that was a little bit different because that group, which does peace building overseas, it gets appropriations from Congress, and it had board members appointed by the president. But also, the president last week in the Oval Office, he was asked about whether he was going to move against nonprofits that serve immigrants and do environmental work, and he said maybe. And he also then lashed out at a group that the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, or CREW, it's a liberal group that has sued him and DOGE.
Has the White House said anything about this new reporting?
Well, we asked the White House, and it sent a response. It said, no EO is in the works or being discussed at this time. Any suggestion otherwise is more gaslighting. Maybe the key phrase there is at this time.
So I also know that there was a pretty unusual meeting this week among a bunch of different nonprofits. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, nonprofit groups, they saw Columbia University's struggle when the administration froze its federal funding. So they're already trying to get together and come up with a united strategy. And they met this past week. And one key player told me, we broke the Zoom because they called an emergency meeting, and in less than 24 hours, 11,000 representatives of nonprofit groups signed up, but the Zoom could only take 5,000. So the ones who could get on that call late Friday, they talked about the threat. Also, what to do to get ready, like auditing their expenses, lining up lawyers. And there are lawyers who have offered pro bono or free legal services to charities and philanthropies that get targeted by the Trump administration.
NPR correspondent Joe Shapiro. Thanks, Joe.
You're welcome, Miles.
This is NPR News.
Influencers are urging people to place their orders at online bargain stores like Shein as prices go up.
Y'all better go ahead and get y'all Shein carts out the way now.
What's prompting their advice? And the Disney Plus Star Wars spinoff Andor returns.
The Empire cannot win.
You'll never feel right unless you're doing what you can to stop them.
On the next Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Russia and Ukraine are each blaming each other for carrying out attacks in violation of a temporary Easter Day ceasefire. The truce was announced in a unilateral move by Russian President Putin yesterday. Google will be back in court tomorrow for the final phase of a landmark antitrust case that could see the online giant broken up. In 2020, a judge ruled Google is a monopoly, accused of paying makers of smartphones and web browsers to make Google the default search engine. Google's ad business is powered by data it gets from user activity on Chrome and Google Search. And a Soyuz space capsule landed in Kazakhstan this morning, carrying two cosmonauts and a NASA astronaut back to Earth. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the University of Buffalo. The University of Buffalo is developing new AI technologies with the goal of solving some of society's most pressing challenges. More at buffalo.edu/AI. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Miles Parks. The Trump administration has halted work on the National Climate Assessment. The report is the most trusted source of information about how climate change affects the United States. Rebecca Hersher from NPR's Climate Desk is here to tell us more. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi.
So tell us a little bit about why this report exists in the first place.
Yeah, so Congress actually requires this report. So going back to the 1990s, the federal government has published a new version every 5 years or so. You know, the last one came out in 2023. The next one was supposed to come out in 2027, but that's basically impossible now because the Trump administration has cut the funding.
Okay, and so who relies on this report? Who uses it?
You know, it's a really big range of people because it has answers to really kind of basic common questions, you know, stuff like how much rain is normal for where I live, or how quickly is the ocean rising? Stuff like, how can I protect myself from wildfire smoke? You know, things that a lot of different kinds of people need to know. And unlike other government reports, it's mostly written in really simple language. It's designed so anyone can use it. So I've talked to teachers, farmers, judges who use it, a lot of local mayors and city planners, fire department officials, and emergency managers. They all rely on this report. It's just really widely used.
And this next edition, it was scheduled to come out in 2027, but I imagine that people were already working on it, considering the depth of information that's in there.
Yeah, exactly. Hundreds of scientists, actually, and they're all volunteers. They don't get paid. But there are a couple dozen staff people who help the scientists. You know, they set up Zoom meetings, they enforce deadlines. Everything that the authors write has to be reviewed by other scientists and by the public before the report comes out to make sure it's right. The staff coordinate all of that work. And the funding for all of those staff was eliminated, according to two officials with direct knowledge of the cuts. And those officials asked that I not use their names because they're afraid of retribution as federal workers.
Okay, so talk me through the impacts here, considering all of these different groups of people who have traditionally relied on this report. What is it going to mean if it just doesn't come out in 2027?
You know, there would be a lot of local effects first. You know, for example, when towns are making decisions about where to put new roads or where to build homes, those are decisions that require climate information. You know, otherwise your road ends up flooding during high tide, your homes end up threatened by wildfire. And the federal government is the main source of that kind of climate information for most parts of the U.S., particularly for smaller communities and for rural areas that really can't compile this kind of scientific information on their own. You know, if you're a big city, you might have your own source, but if you're a smaller place, this report is the place. And there are also some pretty big, kind of unexpected impacts that could show up in the courtroom if this report doesn't come out.
In the courtroom, how does the National Climate Assessment get used in the courtroom?
It's actually a really useful document for judges and juries who are ruling on environmental cases. So remember, this is the most trusted single source of climate information for the U.S. And so it's actually the basis for some pretty big regulations, like federal limits on emissions of planet-warming gases, carbon dioxide and methane, things that cause climate change. So I've talked to some legal experts and to climate scientists who are concerned that if the next edition of the report doesn't come out, or an alternative scenario would be that the Trump administration might put out a version that hasn't been through a rigorous scientific review, then some of those regulations could be challenged in court and could even be overturned, which could lead to even more warming. Now, I reached out to the White House to ask about its reasons for halting work on the climate assessment and about its plans for the report. I did not get a response, but last week the president did suggest that upcoming executive orders could target other environmental topics as well.
NPR climate reporter Rebecca Hersher. Thank you, Rebecca.
Thanks.
If you were a fan of HBO's Succession, you might be interested to learn about Margaret Ives. She's the elusive, fictional media heiress at the center of Emily Henry's new novel, Great Big Beautiful Life. It's a story within a story about two journalists, Alice and Hayden, who are thrown together as they compete to write Margaret's memoir. But this is an Emily Henry book. She is the patron saint of millennial romance, so you know these journalists are not staying just friends. Emily Henry, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I want to start with the relationship between these two journalists. It's in some ways standard romance fare. They meet, they misunderstand each other at first, but then gradually start to fall for each other. But then this book has this whole other layer on top of it of Margaret Ives' century-long family drama. Can you talk to me about why you decided to kind of add this extra layer on top of this genre that it feels like you've kind of mastered at this point?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like you said, I don't know that I'd say I had mastered it, but I've been doing this same general thing for a few years now, and I love it so much, but I definitely wanted to challenge myself in a new way. And so that was part of it. But also, you know, this story kind of came to me just from the idea of wanting to delve deeper into mother-daughter relationships originally. And I really only had one idea that was sort of grounded in that. It kind of sprung, not fully formed, but fairly fully formed from quite early on. And so I didn't make like so much of a conscious decision to make this shift to the side so much as it was the story that was dying to be told inside of me. And, you know, like you said, it's got these two different plots that are running alongside each other, but the real story to me is sort of this third rail that's the way that the two stories interact, and the idea being that neither of them is complete without the other story. They both are braided together to tell this other story that you don't really know what that is until the end of the book.
Obviously, this is a romance book, but there is also a lot of grief in it.
Yeah.
You know, Margaret's story, her whole family's story over the last 100 years is filled with all of this kind of tragedy. And then Alice is also still mourning the fairly recent loss of her dad. This could have been kind of a purely feel-good book. Why did you decide to kind of have so many of these characters also working through grief?
Well, first of all, I generally find it kind of hard to write a love story where you don't deal with grief a little bit, partly because I think when you're getting close to someone, that is just a part of the process. You do this sort of personal excavation where you're sharing the things that matter the most to you and that hurt you the most and that you treasure the most. And then partly because I just do think that grief is the flip side of love. You really cannot have love without grief or grief without love. Like, those things are just two sides of the same coin. And the thing that makes grief bearable is that love is so immense and life-changing and beautiful that we can handle what comes after love. So that is, you know, the short answer. But beyond that, another one of the starting points for this book was just thinking about legacy and the way that the good things and the bad things in our family histories, the generations that come before us get passed down in a way that we don't even necessarily understand. Most of us don't have our family histories preserved as thoroughly as a family like, you know, the British royals or the Kennedys, those families that are in the public eye and have been for generations. We can trace the ripple effects that move through them. And I found that to be just a really interesting concept for how we could explore our own personal sense of legacy by looking at these larger than life storied dynastic families and tracing the way that love and grief especially are passed down from generation to generation, each generation sort of reacting to what it did or didn't get and needed.
Well, and this sense of free will, it feels like, too, of like in that situation, the amount of control that these people have is so much less in a lot of ways, even though they have abundance. And I felt like, to me, the most powerful line in this book was when Margaret was talking about her father and how he didn't do enough for her mother. She says, "For the one you love, you unmake the world and build a new one, if that is what needs doing." And I guess I wonder, how much is this also a book about sacrifice and what it takes to actually successfully keep love alive?
Yeah, I mean, I think the same way that grief is the other side of love, I think sacrifice is intrinsic to love. I think you can like and enjoy and care about people, but love is when you feel something for someone that would make you put them above yourself and your own needs. And when you feel like you would do anything, even things you really, really, really don't want to do for this other person. So I just think that's an inherent part of really loving someone.
One of my favorite things about this book was that you have the kind of the main romance at the center of it, but it actually explores a lot of different romances and marriages, you know, through the generations and through one of my favorite kind of relationships. I'm also a new parent. My child's about to turn one, so I feel like the dynamic of Alice and her dad and her parents and watching that kind of develop throughout the book was really beautifully done. And I wondered how that came about.
Yeah, well, so I've written kind of a lot about father-daughter relationships. It's something I really enjoy both writing and reading about. But this was the first time that I had really tried to drill down into mother-daughter relationships, because I just find them to be fascinating in different ways. I think my relationship with my mom, we're very close, but I do think that there was a sense for a lot of my life that I had, whether she intended this or not, that like her hopes and dreams to some extent maybe were on my shoulders, even if those were sort of vague. And so that was something I really wanted to explore, this idea that, like we were talking about, these good things and these bad things, these excesses and these just losses, all of this gets passed down generation to generation. And the only way to really like reckon with any of it is to have kind of hard conversations. And I wanted to have Alice and her mom deal with the fact that there are these unspoken things in the way of their relationship and get closer because of it.
Well, and I love not viewing kind of the idea of love as so binary, of like romantic love versus like in this book, it feels like, especially with Margaret and her sister, Laura, I feel like their love ends up being such a huge focus as well. And, you know, I just feel like the line between what these different loves mean to these people just becomes kind of blurred.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure people have different experiences of love than I do, but I really feel like love is sort of that thing we were talking about. It's that need to make the world better for someone else, that need to make sure they have what they have before you have what you need. To me, I'm like, love is like, it's so simple. It's not something we can really grasp or make concrete, but I do feel like it's just this simple thing that's in all these different relationships, and it can manifest slightly differently, but I don't necessarily even think that one is more valuable than another, like romantic love versus friend love or familial love. I think all of them matter to each of us on different levels.
I'm not sure it's simple, but I am glad that we have your books to kind of help us all unpack it. Emily Henry's new book is called Great Big Beautiful Life, and it's out April 22nd. Thank you so much, Emily.
Thank you so much. This was great.
Across the country today, kids are rummaging through yards, fields, and parks in search of Easter eggs. But in some parts of Texas,
kids are looking for special kinds of eggs called cascarones, real eggshells filled with confetti. Once kids find them, they break them over each other's heads. And for one woman in Austin, they're also a powerful connection between the generations. Patrick Davis has more.
Easter is a time of rebirth and celebration. But for Denise Solis, it's also a time of loss. Her mother was diagnosed with stomach cancer in 2003.
She was sent home on hospice right before Easter season. And I was like, Mom, you want to make these Easter baskets? And she's like, yeah. And so, you know, she couldn't do a lot of things at that point, but she could fill eggs with confetti.
In those final weeks, Solis spent a lot of time with her mother, meticulously emptying eggshells and filling them with confetti. Her mother died the day before Easter that year, and Solis delivered those Easter baskets, filled with cascarones, to her young cousins the next day.
I remember us, you know, they were the youngest of the family at the time, about 3 and 5, and us chasing each other around the backyard and breaking those eggs, the cascarones, over each other's heads and just thinking how special that was.
Over the last couple weeks, every time Solis cooked an egg, she would carefully poke a hole in the top of the shell, remove the egg, and leave the rest of the shell intact.
You just crack it. I think I found with the knife, you stab it and then peel back immediately the pieces.
Then she rinses and dries the shells. She even dyes some of them bright colors.
Now that they're all dry, we're gonna stuff some confetti in the egg shells. So we put a little white glue around the outside and then put some tissue paper to cover it.
Scholars say cascarones have been a part of Texan Easter celebrations since the state was part of Mexico. Norma Cantu is a humanities professor at Trinity University in San Antonio and grew up with cascarones in Laredo, Texas.
The egg is kind of a symbol for that opening up, for that entrance to a new life. And that's what Easter is. It's the celebration of the resurrection.
Now Solis carries on this tradition with her husband Dominic and their 4-year-old son Noah. She hides the cascarones. And when Noah finds them, that's when the fun starts. Smashing the eggs on each other. Filling their hair with confetti. Solis says cascarones always remind her of her mother.
She was always showering us with love and care and wanting us to feel special and have fun and just seeing the confetti flying in the air, just, I felt the love.
For NPR News, I'm Patrick Davis in Austin, Texas.
Sunday, that's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Miles Parks. Thanks for listening and have a relaxing night.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Subaru. In partnership with the Arbor Day Foundation, Subaru is distributing over 100,000 trees this year to grow greener, healthier communities for generations to come. Subaru, more than a car company. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
traveling down the lonely highway. Know not where the road will end. Not a penny in my pocket. All alone without a friend. In a little country village, I met a man, and he was blind. As I helped him cross the highway, I cried, "My friend, thy burdens are greater than mine. I can see the light of day, and I need not feel my way. Yes, thy burdens are greater